All right, Max, welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks, John, for doing the podcast.
Absolutely. I know, generally speaking, you're gallivanting around Europe broadly. And I think I saw that you have a session or an event you're running at BTC Prague. Is that right?
Yes. BTC Prague is a lovely conference. I enjoyed the first 2 years were incredible. A very well-organized, large event. And looking forward to the third one.
Excellent.
Probably going to be better than before.
Any other, what else is new for you? I know you've got, I'd love to get a glimpse into your short story, if that's something we could get a peek into.
So my background is mainly in economics, right? I've always loved thinking about entrepreneurship and monetary theory, and fell down the Austrian economics rabbit hole quite early in life. And that primed me for Bitcoin, right? But what was missing was more of the technological appreciation of what is free and open source software, what is the cypherpunks, what is encryption. That came later in my life, and that was needed for me to actually grok Bitcoin and really understand why it's so important. Since then, of really making that connection of Bitcoin is unstoppable freedom tech and freedom money, that really led me to do my part in building the tools out there, right? I'm not a developer. I'm more on the, let's say, product side, you know, finding out what should be built and coordinating the devs and motivating them to get things done, you know, getting user feedback, writing the documentation, these type of things. So we need much more than just developers to build the freedom tech, right? Even though it's software, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. So I'm on the other stuff category, everything but code. And nice. I do that for.
Well, in fact, there were two primary reasons I was motivated to invite you. One is you are a triple threat across economics, philosophy, and technology. And I know you claim not to be a software developer, but I think your commit history on GitHub may challenge that. And also because, from my standpoint, you to a large degree live in the future. And you've got a lot to sort of inform those of us, particularly in the Bitcoin community, and the reach, the intention for this show is to reach a broader audience. So for those who are, you know, within the Bitcoin sphere, they'll know you well. For those who are not, you are conducting your life and your business in ways that I think is a real fascinating look at what the future may look like. And certainly people like myself hope that it looks like. And with that, I mean, how do you see Bitcoin fundamentally reshaping the way trust works, both certainly in individual financial transactions, but in a broader societal sense, as compared to traditional institutions?
Yeah, that's a very pressing and an important question, right? And I certainly can say that Bitcoin is something worth the trust, right? Which is maybe difficult for newcomers to see, right? Because we're used to trusting other systems, right? We're used to trusting banks and big institutions and governments. You know, that's just a trust that we've grown up with and that we assume is valid and worthy to give. You know, just before I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole really hard, I signed a 3-year contract to work at Deutsche Bank. So I was in the belly of the beast, so to say, working my way through the institution to really get a glimpse of what it is that it does and who are the people involved in it. And I was shocked of how much the trust of the client was extended to the bank. Banks have an enormous amount of power and privilege to act on behalf of users and recommend them you know, assets and financial vehicles, et cetera. And of course, to trust to custody the money and initiate transactions, et cetera. This is an enormous privilege that is being granted just by default from everyone. So I really came to understand that this trust might not be as well given as it actually is. And so when the 3-year contract was over, the first thing I did was to delete my bank account. So now for the last almost 6 years, I don't have a bank account, neither for myself nor for my businesses. Because why would you give someone this much trust when in the history he has been very much not fulfilling his end of the bargain, so to say, right? The banking system has led to numerous problems in the world, I would say. And now the beautiful thing with Bitcoin is we actually don't need to trust for many things anymore to a financial institution like a bank. We can replace that trust with a trust in Bitcoin, right? And I would argue that this the trust is well earned with Bitcoin, right? We have a fully audible and open source code, right? We see exactly how Bitcoin works, and you can analyze it line by line if you do understand how to code, which I really don't. But a lot of my good friends whom I trust as well have reviewed and audited this code. In fact, I've paid developers to audit the code to make sure that it is doing what we would anticipate it to do, etc. And this just means that we have a monetary network where you for yourself can define, verify, and enforce the rules of the monetary network, and that each and every transaction in this network has followed the rules that were set out at the beginning. Right? It is a quite incredible mechanism where you trust the software to do what it does, right? But ultimately, the software is designed so that you verify for yourself ultimately everything that's happening in this monetary network. And I'm not sure, just making base money transactions, just sending around pieces of gold, so to say, is far from the entire scope of service that a bank provides. And I definitely see that banking as an institution per se, as a business per se, is extremely valuable and will even be valuable in the future with Bitcoin being more broadly adopted. It's just that you won't trust your bank with the same way that you do right now. You don't have to trust your bank to hold your money and to settle your transactions, right? And this is just a big change in how we trust people and whom we trust people, and how do we choose whom to trust? Because there's a lot of new verification technologies out there that really make it possible to be much more careful in whom you gift with your trust.
And I think, I mean, that is absolutely one of the areas of exploration that I'm committed to pursue. And I think for the reasons you point out, there has been this tremendous imbalance that these, let's just pick on financial institutions, banks and the rest, they have had most of the cards, had most of the tools, had most of the power for certain. And that's changing. And I think then, Max, what would you say have been the most painful parts of deleting your bank account, embracing Bitcoin fully? What has been most challenging? What's been most liberating?
Yeah, the challenging part might be that sometimes things take a little bit longer and are a bit more difficult than otherwise. You know, when people actually have a bank card, it feels almost like a superpower to me, you know, because you can just always buy stuff from anyone, ultimately, because everyone accepts bank transfer or credit card payments these days. And so I had to be much more deliberate with whom do I actually want to work with, right? Because just many merchants don't take the currency that I prefer to use. And so that's a bit of an issue. Right? The good thing is, though, that there hasn't been anything that I really wanted that I couldn't get, right? Either by convincing the merchant to take Bitcoin directly, or by working with a proxy merchant, basically. You know, I pay someone in Bitcoin with the task of, hey, please acquire this good and sell it to me, ultimately. So you just add a middleman, right? And I know Bitcoin is kind of meant to destroy the middleman, but I do think that in this network of economic activity, other entrepreneurs are crucial, right? We're never alone on a lonely island just all by ourselves. That's not how the human experience is. It's inherently your system of trusted peers, right? That you have, that you want to collaborate with, and so there are proxy merchants, as one example, ShopInBit, which in my opinion is a very trustworthy merchant, right? Who has proper ethics and understands the value of Bitcoin and the value of privacy, such that you can basically buy anything that you want with this way. And of course, I still use cash, right? Cash is king, at least in the fiat world. That is sometimes though a hassle, especially when you travel a lot. You show up in a place and you simply don't have the local currency. Right? This then requires you to meet people, which is also fantastic, because if you hold Bitcoin and you want to acquire some fiat paper, well, you're on the easy side of the trade. There's a lot of people who want to get their hands on Bitcoin and want to get rid of the fiat as soon as possible. And so this is a great opportunity to meet people who actually care about protecting themselves and their wealth with Bitcoin. So it's a great opportunity to meet new friends.
Yes. And I mean, that ability to, or that motivation to localize, I think is a big part of the shift that I hope is coming away from these centralizing factors to, you know, whether it is, as folks that we would probably both know would say, shake your rancher's hand, shake your farmer's hand, to having the ability wherever you go to reach out to those, as you say, who want to be on the other side of that trade. In a bit more specifics, or more specifically, Wasabi Wallet. So I'd love for you to give those who may not know, as I say, those in the Bitcoin sphere certainly will know you and the product well. But for those who don't, please give us an overview of Wasabi Wallet. With it and your focus on privacy tools, I think more generally, you're arming individuals against mass surveillance. Those are my words, not yours. What's the biggest challenge people face in reclaiming financial privacy today and in rebalancing this imbalance of power and the dynamics of trust that exists there?
Yeah, the very first feedback that Satoshi got after publishing the white paper, right, the draft of hey, this is the Bitcoin system, this is how it could work, it was pretty obvious. And it resonates with what I said earlier, right? You verify every transaction of everyone else in the history of the existence of the money, right? That's ridiculous, right? That doesn't scale because it isn't private, right? If you need to read and review every transaction everyone ever made, first of all, that's a hell of a lot of transactions. And so that just takes a lot of time. Thankfully, we have computers to do that work for us, but still requires a lot of compute power. But then also, you have the issue that you read the transaction of everyone else. That's kind of a privacy nightmare, right? Imagine your worst enemy knowing exactly what you spend, when and where and how much and how much money you have left over, right? This is quite a peculiar situation that the Bitcoin protocol puts us in. Thankfully, there are numerous improvements of how to be more careful with which information do you reveal about your financial transactions to other people, to third parties. And there are tricks like, for example, to use a new Bitcoin address for each time you get paid, and instead of using the same identity to get paid across time, right? Which does a fair deal in keeping you more private.
And would it be fair to say, again, Max, just thinking of those who may not be as deep in this, it's like the ability to spin up a new checking account to receive a payment, rather than having this unified ledger. Well, I shouldn't, because we do have the unified ledger with Bitcoin, but the one bucket of transactional data in your checking or savings account with Bitcoin, we have the ability to spin up new addresses and to some degree disconnect. And I know you'll get into more detail about how Wasabi Wallet further aids that goal.
Yeah, exactly. So the address is the identifier of who can spend that money, and right? It's like your public key. It's your account number, as you said. And if we use the same account number across multiple payments, and remember that everyone sees exactly to which account number does the money get sent, then anyone can clearly say, hey, this account got paid 10 times in the past, and he's now holding a total balance of 100 Bitcoin or something, and he hasn't spent them for 10 years. And so this seems to be an OG who has quite a lot of Bitcoin and who's still saving them. And now if you send some money to this person, you can see the past of their financial transactions as well. And just assume that if you buy coffee on a coffee store and all of a sudden the barista can see exactly, hey, how much money does that guy actually have? And that's a bit of a tricky situation that we're not used to in the legacy system, right? If you pay with a card, the barista doesn't know how much money you have and where you got it from. But in the nature of Bitcoin as a system, he very much can easily find this out. And that is quite a harsh difference to the previous systems. And this is where Wasabi Wallet ultimately comes in. It's a wallet, so it's a way to generate new private keys and new addresses, new accounts, so to say, as many as you want, right? And to securely and privately find out how much money do you have on these accounts, which is another thing where again, you would need a Bitcoin full node, a software that verifies the entire history of the blockchain, of all the transactions that has happened, in order to retrieve privately how much money you have. And Wasabi was the first wallet to figure out how we can find out how much money the user has without sending the user's addresses to a third-party server. And so this private balance lookup, so to say, was one of Wasabi's great inventions. And then further, we want to make sure that those addresses that we have received money on in the past can actually now be spent without revealing that they belong to each other, right? So let's say one time you get paid by your employer and the other time you get paid by your mother or someone, and you maybe don't want your mom to know how much money you actually earn in your business, right? So how can we spend our entire wallet balance without revealing to one party that you've also received this other transaction? So, and again, with Bitcoin, these threats are not just with the people whom you interact with, the people whom you send money to and the people who pay you. It's also a problem of the entire world can look at these transactions that you're making. And this is where CoinJoin as a technology comes in. It's ultimately a collaborative Bitcoin transaction. So instead of making a Bitcoin transaction with only one user, we make a Bitcoin transaction with hundreds of users. And this increases the size of the crowd that we're hiding in, so to say, which is quite a common tactic to improve users' privacy. It's just to batch many users together in one activity. The third pillar of how Wasabi protects your privacy ultimately is with the Tor network, a very sophisticated implementation of using the Tor network to ensure that, again, no two communications that your wallet does are linked to the same identity.
Where do you, Max, see this going inevitably? And I'll interrupt myself to say, again, for those who may not be familiar with the tools that we operate today, as we all know, we could spend hours talking about this, certainly, in a place where financial institutions, governments, regulators assume, demand the right to know everything about every transaction and every person. There are many of us, myself, yourself included, who would argue that that is not the natural state of affairs. And the tools you're building, the products you contribute to, are seeking to rebalance. So the path we're on, not being able to necessarily see into the splintering paths of every regulatory regime that could throw us a curveball, where are we headed? How private, how, as I'll continue to say, rebalanced is the trust relationship between us and either financial institutions, should we choose to interact with them, or other individuals? So in short, where are we headed?
I think we're heading in a tremendously great trajectory. If you would go back 20 years from now, maybe 30 years, and you would ask the early cypherpunks, you know, the pioneers of digital privacy, on what are the goals? What would we like to have? We would want to have, you know, a secure way of making payments, in which we have Bitcoin. It would be great if that's private. We have CoinJoins. We have the Lightning Network, right? And we want to communicate with each other in a private way. Now we have encryption for this since quite a long time, in a way that it cannot be stopped. Now we have the Nostr protocol for this as well. So just like the main pillars, the main targets of the cypherpunks have been achieved. We have anonymous, resilient communication, base money, and transactions, like right now. And that's fantastic. On a technological front, we've basically achieved everything that we've set out to achieve. Now, technology is not everything, right? Especially when it comes to security technology. Security technology only works, it can only protect you if the user actually resists an attacker. If the user is happy to hand over his data, hand over his money to whoever comes knocking, ultimately, then no amount of technology can help you. And an analogy would be you have a couple bars of gold and you want to protect them well. So you get all the best technology, you get a safe deposit box, you know, big steel walls, you simply put them in a bunch of cement, make sure they cannot be moved, right? You hire a couple armed guards with guns and a tank, you know, in front of it, to stand in front of it, to really make sure nobody gets into it. But then the first person comes along and is like, hey, I would like to get your gold, please. And you go, okay, sure, right? You put the gun away, you open the door to the vault, and voila, the the very substantially good security technology was not able to protect you because security is always a human problem ultimately. And that's why having the tools is only part of the battle. We need to instill a act of resisting an attacker into the hearts and minds of individuals. Right? And this is where podcasts like this come in, right? To fight the cultural battle, so to say, to normalize the act of protecting your property, right? which I would argue in history has throughout times been more or less prevalent. The good thing is, though, that now we have a rebalancing of the cost to attack and the cost to defend. And it is now extremely cheap to defend yourself to a very large extent, such that the attack becomes extremely expensive. And now we have a way that millions, billions of people can profitably protect themselves, even if they're not that wealthy, and therefore make the cost of the attacker even larger, right? Because now it's no longer possible to attack millions of people at the same time as is done with Dragnet surveillance. And so here, I think we have, on a technological realm, we basically have won the battle. And now culture is downstream of technology. And it might take, you know, a generation or two to really get where we are at, right? To understand and to appreciate what this is, and of course to continue building the technology. But ultimately that cultural mindset will change and shift. And then finally, politics is downstream of culture. And so we will see a lot of different regulatory approaches to how we deal with these technologies and hopefully in a more sane and more liberating way.
Do you see catalysts that will accelerate that cultural shift and adoption, let's say, as compared to or in conjunction with winning hearts and minds, education, the work that you and others do in writing and other media? Are there catalysts that you see accelerating that cultural shift, or do we just need to be patient?
I think a great catalyst is an attacker, ultimately. As soon as you feel the pain of an attack or the threat of an attack, you're probably going to do something about this. And maybe the best example of this is last couple of years, COVID. Right? The quite draconian crackdown of governments on individual freedoms was substantial. And a lot of people realized that, hey, I would like to have at least some inkling of freedom in my life and the ability to make choices without having the threat of violence hanging over me. I think this created a lot of anarchists ultimately and introduced a lot of people to Bitcoin. The best marketing efforts for Bitcoin and other freedom technologies is continuous government overreach. And it doesn't seem like they're going to stop anytime soon.
We can bank on it, right? To use a phrase. Well, and that is, I think, a great seg into something you mentioned, and certainly I'm a proponent and advocate of and see a tremendous amount of promise, which is Nostr. And so I'd love to chat for a minute, Max, about where Nostr fits in the array of protocols, freedom technologies that will continue to help us decentralize and to shift more to local and to empowering the individual, and then any other promising protocols or technologies that you see alongside that perhaps others should pay attention to.
Yeah, Nostr is a wonderful set of tools and protocols. It's very similar in essence to PGP, the Pretty Good Privacy Protocol by Phil Zimmerman in the early 90s or something when this was developed. It relies on private public key cryptography. So you can easily create an identity simply by throwing a couple dice or coins to get a random number. That's your identity. And now you can sign messages, meaning you can prove to other people that this message has been seen by you and has been authorized by you. Right? Those are cryptographic signatures. Bitcoin uses them as well to prove that you have the authority to spend a coin. And you can also encrypt messages, right? So I can encrypt a message to Sean's public key such that anyone who has this encrypted ciphertext cannot read it until or unless he has the private key that Sean has generated. And so PGP never really took off because it was quite cumbersome to use and the software just wasn't there yet. And maybe we didn't have the imagination of what could actually be done with all of this. And then Bitcoin was probably one of the pioneering private public key systems that really took off, right? And so Noster takes some of those principles and just puts a unique spin on it, right? Specifically, the content of these messages that we're signing and encrypting is now standardized, right? Meaning we have a different standard for making public posts, like a short form tweet, you know? We have a different standard for blog posts, and we have a different standard for publishing the release of a software, right? And there is now hundreds, maybe even thousands of different standards on how to create the signed a message, right? And how to interpret it such that we don't just have one application that deals with all of this. We have hundreds at this point, and nobody can prevent you from creating a new application that follows one or more of these standards on how to create and interpret these signed messages. And this now means we have a liberation of possibilities for developers to come up with great applications that utilize this private public key cryptography system in an open manner. Because the genius inside is that as soon as we have a signed message, it does not matter where you have received this message from. If you get it from a trusted server like twitter.com, or if you get it on a USB stick, or if someone shouts it at you, just an anonymous person, right? As soon as you have this signed message, you can, without trusting anyone, without trusting the person who gave you this message, you can verify that it was authored by the person with the private key. And otherwise, it could not have been signed. It's a mathematical proof. And again, crucial in the trust paradigm that we're talking about here. And now this means that we can put our messages not just on one server, like twitter.com, facebook.com, right? But we can put them on hundreds of servers. You can run a server for yourself. You can run that server or a Noster relay on your phone, right? It does not matter where these messages are stored and gathered anymore. As soon as the user gets the message, he can verify by himself that the authenticity is valid, and which is a mind-blowing shift in the security and architectural design of how to create applications. And so the list of amazing Noster projects is endless, right? You have the social media experience, like something like Amethyst, for example, or Damus. Similar to Twitter, right? You can create short form posts, people can like them, and people can send money for them as well, right? Because we can now add metadata to our cryptographically signed network of nodes, so to say, of, hey, this is my Bitcoin address. Here you can send me money to. And you can attest that someone has sent money to you. And so now we have the social payment experience of, if you want to reveal that, hey, I just got paid by this person, then you can, which now also means that we have an additional signal for which messages are valuable, which messages are useful. Those messages who got paid a lot of Bitcoin for are probably interesting to read. So this enables us just to get an entirely new set of ways that we can filter and highlight messages that might be valuable to the end user. And we're basically creating a web of trust where we have different categories of this metadata, this information might be useful to the user. And it's not spam. It is something that the user might want to see. Right? And this might be something like, hey, you're following this user, so here's the notes that he's sending. Or maybe you follow a friend of that user, right? So there's one hop of separation, right? Or maybe your friends are sending money to the nodes of this other user. Maybe you should look at that, right? All of these design systems are possible now. And it goes much more than just text, right? You can do the same with videos, for example. That's where the Blossom protocol comes in, where you can host large files, you know, not just text, images, videos, etc., in a similar architecture where each video file is clearly identified by a hash and short fingerprint, basically, of the data. And you can sign, you know, and say, hey, look, this is the data that I'm referring to. We can be sure that every picture that is posted has not been tampered with. Right? A huge protection against, for example, AI deepfakes that we see nowadays. But we also have an open marketplace in this. Now you can say that, hey, this is a trusted merchant, and here are the products that he is offering, and you can securely and directly communicate with him. you can do the Internet of Things without any, you know, weird Chinese server that sends all of your, you know, every time you turn on the light bulb or something, that this gets logged by some third-party server. No, this can just be done by you and your relay, right? That is all inside your home network. So this Nostr is really a pivotal shifting of the trust spectrum by relying a lot more on cryptographic assurances rather than on a single server that we deem is the whole purveyor of the truths, right? And that can change messages without the end user ultimately knowing. All of these things are no longer possible with Nostr, and that's just incredibly exciting.
It is incredibly exciting. I am hard-pressed to say how bullish I am about Nostr. You know, if Bitcoin is unstoppable money, Nostr is unstoppable communications, in my view. Sorry. And I think, you know, to your point, whether it's authenticity, attribution, the ability to cryptographically, definitively prove these things is incredible. I don't know if you're probably familiar with Zapstor, Max. Have you had a look? So Zapstor is mobile. Well, actually, I think it's platform agnostic, but it is taking the App Store and decentralizing it and using the Nostr Web of Trust. So if I were to choose, particularly on Android, I think I'm an iPhone guy at present, but if I were to download a random APK, if I were to use one of the various third-party non-Google affiliated app stores, maybe I get good code, maybe I get malware, who knows, right? And with Zapstor, I have the ability to see via my web of trust, my follows, my followers, who also trusts that code, who has chosen to trust that code and that developer. And I won't do it full justice here, but it takes the centralizing effect of an Apple or a Google being thou who shalt, you know, validate code and validate apps and declare that it's safe and good for you to install. And it puts it back in the hands of the individual based upon, as you mentioned, their web of trust. And so I think that's incredibly powerful. You know, you touched in that, Max, on the transactional capabilities, be it Zaps to, for those who don't know, it's so-called value for value. So, you know, one of the reasons that reminded me to reach out to you, Max, was some of your posts on Nostr have been, I've certainly been enjoying them. And I think that there are tremendous distillations, as I say, you know, earlier, your triple threat across economics, philosophy, and technology. And so I have the ability to send you Satoshis, to send you small fractions of a Bitcoin, which is real money and real value, and for the value that I get back. So that's certainly powerful. But I think more broadly, we're seeing marketplaces develop. We're seeing peer-to-peer exchange and trade happening more broadly. And that takes me to some of your writing about the second realm and economic freedom. And you've talked about, and maybe we'll start with, please, you explaining, you know, what the second realm is to those who don't know, a parallel economy based on Bitcoin. And so for those who may be peeking in, peering in from where they are today, which is using traditional financial institutions, consuming traditional media, et cetera, but maybe they've got that inkling, as you said, maybe it was lockdowns, maybe it was something else that gave them that inclination to look. What practical steps can individuals take to begin to step in to that second realm? So first, what is it? And second, you know, what are some of those early steps that those who are curious can take?
The second realm is a fascinating concept, really articulated by some of the OG cypherpunks. You know, talking about PGP earlier, there was a big fight against PGP from the government, of course. And one way that this fight was won was that we printed the PGP source code on a book and sent it from America to Europe, and to prove that this is not an export of arms. This is simply knowledge being shared. So guess who received the first book of the PGP source code in Europe? It was the author of the book, The Second Realm, right? And the book highlights that there are two realms, right? There is the first realm of coercion and violence, right? The system of the state, ultimately. And then there is the second realm, which is, as you so nicely said, a parallel economy. It is where people meet and communicate and gather and trade without the purview of others and without necessarily asking for permission, simply because they want to help each other. And this second realm has always existed, right? There was always a king who demanded tribute, and always people who were just like, yeah, we're just going to do it here on the side without the king really knowing about it. But the system or this parallel culture was really kicked into gear with the advent of cypherpunk technologies and freedom tech, where we have now secure encryption, where we have anonymous communications, where we have anonymous digital payments. This means that we can now work on an economy that is much larger, much more sophisticated than was previously deemed possible. Right? We can build entire, you know, huge constructs without revealing who the people involved in the trade are. And so this means that we have a way, again, to establish more freedom in the life of everyone, in a way that's quite difficult to stop, quite expensive to stop. And simultaneously, it is easy to use, right? So we decrease the cost of defense and increase the cost of attack. And so how to participate in this economy, there's another great piece of writing called The Aristocracy of Action. Right? You don't need to sign up. You don't need to write a petition. You don't need to ask for permission to be part of the second realm. You just do it, right? As soon as you help your friends and family, as soon as you interact with your neighbor on a peaceful, on a voluntary way, you're a part of the second realm. You're living in anarchy where we value our contracts, where we value the ethic of providing work and solving problems. That's all that's needed. Just be useful. And you know, start a side business. Get some chicken and sell the eggs. You know? Make your own soap and sell it on Noster. Produce some leather wallets or whatever it is. Of course, write software. Right? Software development is a fantastic trade in the second realm because it is being provided online, can be shipped to billions of people at the press of a button and the signing of a Zap Story event, right? For release. So it's really quite easy nowadays to be part of the second realm and to live a life that's just a bit freer. And another great realization is that you don't need to be all in to the freedom realm. In fact, that might be quite risky, right? There is this concept of the parallel nepolis, right? The parallel economy, the parallel society, so to say. And this was penned by Václav Bender. He was a freedom fighter in the Czechoslovakia during the Russian or Soviet occupation. And he realized that if you're outright hostile and disobedient against the state, then you simply get put to the gulag, right? And you die, you know, or your kids or your cousins will never be able to go to university, right? Because they were part of the family of a dissent. That simply was not tolerated. So to be completely in the second realm, so to say, and publicly so, outright so, is extremely dangerous in some situations. And so what you can do is to still be part of the first realm, right? To have in your little business the big sign of workers of the world unite. Now, even though you know it's a bullshit lie and everyone else knows that it's a bullshit lie, right? But you still do it because if you don't, you go to the gulag, right? However, in the evenings, you know, you take your kids out of the public school and you actually teach them about logic and reason and poetry and the beautiful things that free minds can come up with, right? And that is the parallel economy. It's the underground speakeasies, you know, where you gather with free minds and share ideas and shape a reality that you would actually like to be part of. And since there is no exclusion to be entirely in the first realm or entirely in the second realm, this is also a great opportunity for one of the business models we've mentioned earlier, that of the proxy merchant. Because the second realm is rather limited in size compared to the first one, it's a great business to put goods from the second realm into the first, from the first into the second, and play this arbitrage game ultimately. So this is one of the many good businesses that is possible nowadays, right? Like, you want to get more Bitcoin? There are people who have Bitcoin and don't have bank accounts, as one example, and want to get other stuff. So you buy the other stuff for them with your fiat, right? And you sell it to them for Bitcoin. That is one of the great business models that's possible.
Tremendous. And I think to your point, it can sound, and again, I'm imagining those perhaps new to the ideas even of Bitcoin, it can sound outrageous, rebellious, anarchistic, certainly, which, you know, we would argue, I think by the academic proper definition, it is. But I think it also, to me, tell me if you see it differently, is, again, a return to localism. It's a return to community. It's a return to, you know, I am as guilty as anyone for the number of boxes that show up at the front door from Amazon. We're trying to get better at that. But I think in large part, this is enabling individuals to conduct commerce, to trade, to engage, to be less reliant on, again, centralizing factors and to be more connected and engaged with their local communities, which is, I think, about as wholesome as it gets. But
yeah, exactly.
To your point, there are those who push back. There are those who will push back against it.
Yeah, anarchy is quite a scary sounding word, right? But ultimately, it's about helping your neighbors, right? To being useful to others. It just means anarchon, comes from the Greek, meaning without and rulers, right? So, you know, simply as soon as two people meet and you know, have a good time and shake hands and walk away peacefully, that's anarchy. It's as simple as that.
Fantastic. So I'm moving us backwards, I guess you could say, from technology, economics, and now philosophy. And so you think that we were going to get away without talking about praxeology. So and human action. And so your work, you'll correct me, is informed by praxeology, the study of purposeful human behavior. How does this philosophy guide your development of the tools that you build and that you contribute to, like Wasabi Wallet? And what does it teach us about the whys and the hows of trusting code tools, that which can be observed and studied, pardon me, over institutions?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And a big question is, what is money, right? And why do we use it? And is it good technology? Is it useful, right? And I would argue that most schools of economic thought simply cannot answer this question adequately. But praxeology and the Austrian tradition very much can. Right? This goes back to Karl Menger and Ludwig von Mises and Rothbard and Hoppe, who really articulate the immense value and utility of money, right? And really give profound and deep reasonings for it. And specifically, Jörg-Guido Hultzmann is great on this, on the ethics of money production, right? On the ethical quality of different monetary systems, right? And if a fiat monopoly money is a good thing, or versus a free competitive money like Bitcoin or gold, which of these systems is preferable? Which of these systems lead to better outcomes for its participants? Right? And here again, praxeology is just absolutely spot on. Right? As soon as you have a monopoly on who can produce the monetary units, then you introduce seigniorage. Right? This is where you can print money at a profit. Ultimately, it costs the U.S. government what, 17 cents to produce a $100 note, and maybe by now it's 25 cents because even printing money gets more expensive. Printing paper gets more expensive, right?
Pushing the button goes up in cost.
Yeah, and that's why ultimately they stopped printing creating the 1 cent coin, right? Because, or are thinking to, because it costs them what, 20 cent to produce the 1 cent coin, the penny. That's simply not profitable anymore, right? So there's no senior rush here, no gain for printing money. And as soon as you have that, you mess with the supply and demand as a concept, right? People demand more things because they don't have to pay the full dollar for a good. Right? They only have to pay 2 cents on the dollar or whatever percentage it is, because they can print it more cheaply than they can sell it for. And this leads to all types of distortions in the market, specifically malinvestments. Right? So we invest in projects that are worse than they otherwise would have been, projects that take longer to consume, projects that are more complex. Hayek would say projects that are more roundabout in their production stages. Right? And simultaneously, we overconsume, right? We order a bunch of stuff from Amazon that we probably don't really need, just because it's so, you know, easily available, and we can just click a button and, hey, we, you know, didn't really have to work hard to earn that money, so why not spend it and have a bit of a good time, right? And those two forces together, the malinvestment and the overconsumption, leads to a depletion of actually scarce resources. And we only have this number of steel, of concrete, of wood, etc. in the economy. And if we keep building houses and skyscrapers that are getting bigger and bigger, and simultaneously, you know, we're burning a lot of wood to heat our house, etc., resources run out. And this leads to the bust, right? Where we simply cannot finish the construction of a building, not because we wouldn't like to, but because we don't have the raw materials anymore. We don't have the resources, including human time, to finish the goods, right? And because we've started too many projects at once, ultimately. That is the bust period that arises from having seen a rush on the money, from having a monopoly on who can print the money. This is such a devastating cost for humanity. It's unbelievable. It's such a monumental, such a huge number of waste, of destruction and missed opportunity, that it's so painful to think where we could have been if we wouldn't have stolen so much over the last 100,000 years. It's just heartbreaking, you know? So this is where really praxeology gives you a reason to care, right? Because it explains to you where we could have been. What are the unseen, the unrealized capacity or capabilities of humankind? Once you get that, you realize that it's of utmost, of like, you know, human extinction level importance that we fix the money, right? And that we stop these institutionalized systems of theft that have crept in and have been enforced for way too long.
I would argue, forgive me, Max, that what you just said to me is the crux of it, which is, and I appreciate that praxeology is deserving of a series of lectures, not a 15-minute conversation, but you'll correct me that it is a lens through which we can properly see that which these institutions have done, have stolen, have corrupted, and therefore why it is worth, back to our conversation earlier, it's worth investing the effort, the time, the energy, the cognitive dissonance to adopt things like Bitcoin and Nostr. Could you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. When you see the cost and of the problem, right, specifically money printing, but other government intervention as well, then that's a lot of pain, right? That's a lot of fear. And that's a distressing situation, right? When you realize the cost, and you might not see a way out. And here is where the hope of the cypherpunks, you know, that glimmer of hope at the horizon of, hey, we actually can build a better world, where theft becomes unprofitable, where printing money becomes unprofitable, right? And this gives us hope of where we could be in the future. And those two things are in combination extremely motivational. Right? When you have the fear of the systems that we have created in the past and the real cost that they produce, and on the other side, the hope of a real possibility of creating new systems that don't suffer off the same flaws, that just means you're going to work your ass off once you make that realization. And this was certainly the case for myself. I've never been more productive than in those last couple of years, where I really have made this connection and realized of the extent of this, and I see it in a lot of my peers, that people care extremely to fix the world and have an actionable plan on how to achieve that. And that is a dangerous combination, because not just are we motivated to work overtime nonstop, but we're not wasting our time on strategies misapplied. We actually have a quite clear cut on how to reach the top of the mountain, and we're just running as hard as possible, and that is exhilarating to work at. Right? So that's just my open invitation to anyone who starts to glimpse the pain and the hope that we have in front of us. to come join us and run up the hill.
Perfect bridge to what I'd like to discuss in closing with you, Max, which is, I think, again, you're uniquely qualified to offer suggestions, advice in this regard. I believe I recall that you mentioned, perhaps it was Peter McCormick's conversation, that you began your entrepreneurial path at 15, I think it was.
I think it was even earlier than that. My first job was bringing out the newspaper. I think I was 9 or 10. I don't recall at the moment.
I robbed you of a few years. And so you've been at it. And as I say, you've got, and I'll be sure, of course, in the show notes to make sure everyone is aware of the various projects that you've built, contributed to, led. And so with that, with your history as an entrepreneur, your history as a builder, as someone who understands the economics and the philosophical impact of where we're headed, I think you and I both assume, more so believe deeply, that we are headed toward this future that I think you've eloquently laid out. How should a business leader, founder, CXO, who again is peeking over the fence, how should they rethink their business models, their operations, on the topic of trust, perhaps most pertinently, their customer relationships to thrive in this future that, as I said at the outset, you live in and that you're building toward?
Well, if your business relies on coercion, right, on forcing people to use your service, then anticipate that you're going to lose customers, especially when a freer alternative to your service arises and becomes profitable to provide, right? And don't take this as a threat. Take it as an opportunity, because there are ways to make money, to make a lot of money, without sacrificing your users, right? You make money not because people are forced to work with you. You make money because you solve problems for others. And there's a hell of a lot of problems to be solved out there in basically any business line. So just be useful, you know, be helpful to others, and make that the core ethos of the business, rather than how can we exploit our users the most in the next 3 months, right? See how you can be part of a multi-generational solution to extremely large problems, and that will be the biggest moat that you have, ultimately. And utilize the latest cutting edge technologies. Right? Freedom Tech is incredible. It's mind blowing of what really is possible at this moment with Bitcoin, obviously. So I mean, if you're not holding Bitcoin as a treasury, then what are you doing? Right?
Michael Saylor would like to have a word with you.
Exactly. And the 15 plus years of track record of Bitcoin just outperforming and everything else, right? And maybe, like, if your hurdle rate is still the S&P 500, if you aim to perform 10% every year, right, and make that money for your investors, then I hate to break it to you, but you're losing money, because your investors could have just bought Bitcoin and did nothing. Right? Just hold base money without any counterparty risk, without the fear that, you know, the manager runs away with the money or does some stupid investment decisions. None of that. And you would have made 100% per year. Right, so Bitcoin is the real hurdle rate. That's what you need to outperform for your investors to be happy in the long run. And so the easiest way to outperform Bitcoin is simply to hold Bitcoin, so that you at least break even. So that's an important first step. And then really be careful and cautious with how you allocate your resources. Because again, we've printed so much money in the last 1,000 years, 100 years especially, 10 years especially, right? It's incredible how much money was printed. And this means that everyone is being tricked, right? And you're no exception to it. You've made investments and consumptions in the past that were absolutely stupid, and you should not have done that, right? But you were tricked by a broken monetary system to think that that was a profitable thing. It was profitable on paper, denominated in the hyperinflating currency, yes. But it's not in a sound monetary system. And so the sooner you realize that and you stop the frugalist spending and malinvestment, you're gonna make new heights in outperforming and generating a return. So ultimately, this isn't really rocket science. You know, be useful, save your money, only invest what you can actually do into profitable ventures that return more than you've spent. And you know, those very simple business and accounting obvious points are absolutely valid. And they become even more valid when you apply them with the lens of Bitcoin.
Huge. In addition to that, are there, if we you know, the money is the thing for certain. And as you say, if it's not part of your treasury strategy, then you're losing. Other freedom technologies, be it Nostr or other, are there, put you on the spot a bit here, but are there categories of opportunity that you see if in the scenario that we see playing out, there's an increasing breakdown of centralized entities? You know, ex-Twitter undergoes massive DDoS attack. Those of us on Nostr are happily communicating, you know, and admittedly our small sphere, but we think growing. So are there shifts of that nature that are coming, that are disruptive for certain, and that you see opening up perhaps other opportunities in addition to hold the right money, hold sound money?
Yeah, there's a lot of useful business, right? Always has been and always will be. Humans have a lot of problems. We're very troubled creatures, so to say, which sucks to one extent because, well, we have to suffer through the problems. But on the other hand, it's a huge opportunity to provide entrepreneurial services and fix those problems. Food, you know, that's a big, big industry, and it got completely wrecked, absolutely incredibly wrecked in the last, you know, 100 years again, since the money printer has been going. So produce real food, you know, not overproduced toxic chemical bullshit, but sell beef jerky, you know, beef and salt, dry it, and that's done. That's all you need for a proper product. And you know, that's a massive, massive industry. The healthcare system, obviously, is primarily designed to make us sick and to keep us as a patient, and to keep buying more and more medicines and expensive treatments. Provide services that make people healthy. That's like a, you know, people don't like to die and people don't like to be sick. So that's, again, another evergreen opportunity to provide very valuable products that will be bought like crazy. If you have a non-toxic, actually healing technologies, that's massive, right? The banking, I would say as well. Like, yeah, we don't like banks at the moment because they are creatures of the state and crony and heavily involved in the theft. But they don't have to be. Banking is a beautiful and ethical venture. I think Murray Rothbard is excellent on this point. The Mystery of Banking, a phenomenal book that goes under all the numerous ways that banks can be useful, right? So provide banking services on top of Bitcoin, right? We're starting to see that slowly with the Bitcredit protocol, by the way. It's a bill of exchange protocol on top of Bitcoin and Nostr and eCash. So, you know, we have money warehousing banks now with eCash, both centralized or single issuer entities like Cashew, or even federated money warehouses like Fediment, which, by the way, federated money warehouses were also invented by the guy who wrote The Second Realm and received the first book on PGP. So just to show you that, like, one random dude can really change the world substantially.
The William Gibson quote, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. William Gibson, Bruce Sterling, I forget which, but so often timing is everything, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe architecture, you know, people like boxes. We create boxes all the time. We live in boxes. So build beautiful boxes. And, you know, the list of real, honest, good work that has to be done is substantial. It extends far across the digital domain, right? Hopefully with time and Bitcoin and Nostr continuing to grow and expand and other digital tools, it will help us to reprioritize our physical meat space work as well. Another one, of course, is secure facilities. Right? We don't like to be stolen from or physically hurt. So providing safe spaces is a great opportunity. And that goes, you know, in small scales, like a hotel or a restaurant, but it goes larger. I think private cities, charter cities, are going to be massive in this coming
area.
Years. Claim new territory. go out and seastead the oceans, you know, build vessels that never have to dock on land and create entire new living spaces out on the huge ocean. Yeah, the list of great business models is endless. So if you're lacking ideas, hit me up.
I love that we've gone from beef jerky to seasteading. That's fantastic. And I think the takeaway that I have and love about these conversations is there is tremendous hope. There is vast opportunity. And for any of the hurdles, be they cognitive or otherwise, that we need to cross to get there, it is absolutely worth it. Well, Max, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a delight. I hope we get to pick this up again soon. For those not familiar, and I'll certainly be sure these are in the show notes, where can, should we follow you and your work?
Yeah, I'm exclusively posting on Nostr these days. So you can find my public key on max@towardsliberty.com. Follow me there, hit me up with any questions, and support the projects that really deserve it. We've mentioned a lot of them already, and there are many more, right? And maybe specifically if you need any help with creating and a digital setup to protect your Bitcoin and really want to get some hands-on consulting on how to traverse this path and these different technologies, you can find my consulting work at soundmoneysolutions.io. And that goes for individuals as well as institutions who would like to explore their Bitcoin strategy a bit further.
Fantastic. Thanks again so much, Max. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Sean, for the invite. This was a really fun conversation, and I'm looking forward to hear the other episodes that you got planned here. This is a great podcast.
Very good. Thanks. Pleasure. Thanks, Max.